Okay, so we have a little binder there, and we've got a bunch of introductory materials. They have pages numbered before we actually get to our first psalm. And some of it's, you know, basic background material that I was just going to start in terms of background to the psalm material. So the first one there on page one is the thumbnail of Israel's history. So I'm just going to take us through what happened, biblical history, you know, and situate the psalmist where in that time frame it is. So history begins in our world around 3500 B.C. So 3500 B.C. is not on here, but, you know, it's after the flood. The flood is somewhere in the 5000 to 10,000 B.C. range, Noah's flood. History begins basically over in Iraq. So Babylon and Assyria, the two dominant world empires that we'll be talking about through this time, are basically the nation of Iraq and the nation of Syria, and a little bit of Turkey. There's that thing that we learned, and remember in grade school, about the Fertile Crescent, where, and that's the Fertile Crescent is from, you're looking at the map, it's being north. It's the Tigris-Euphrates River that comes up from the Persian Gulf through Baghdad now, through Iraq. It goes into Syria and Turkey. So the Syria-Turkey border is right between those two rivers historically. And then it comes down the coastline along Israel. So Israel is, it comes across Syria and down through Lebanon, where Lebanon is now, fertile, very fertile area, down through basically where Egypt is. So that little Fertile Crescent is where civilization as we know it begins. And the only way we know it begins is they start writing stuff down. History begins at Sumeria, Babylon, etc., in the Tigris-Euphrates Fertile Crescent. And it starts at 3500 B.C. for some reason. At 3500 B.C., we find the first writing. And it's an explosion. And it's legal documents, it's accounting documents of trade, it's receipts, and it's stuff that's thrown in a rubbish pile. In other words, it's documents that are no longer current. They've paid their taxes, they throw away their data. Okay? And if Don were here, I'd make the joke that the world's oldest profession is actually not what we normally call it, but it's actually accounting. So it's actually the first things we have are accountants and lawyers. Documents, contracts, they're there from day one. And that's around 3500 B.C. And then we get to Abraham here. Abraham lives in Sumer. He lives there between the Tigris and Euphrates River and the city of Ur. Okay, so he would live in modern-day Iraq, basically, down toward the Persian Gulf. And God calls Abraham and says, you need to leave this house, get out of here. And so he, his father, and the grandfather start moving along this Fertile Crescent to come over to what would later become the nation of Israel. Okay, so they, at about 2000, 2200 B.C., they start this trek up the Fertile Crescent. And there are various stopovers there. There's some very famous sites archaeologically along that road. But at 2000 B.C., there is a university that's over 1,000 years already over in Ebla, the famous places of Ebla. And there's a university there that has one of the largest libraries of the ancient world. They have visiting professors that would come in from the other cities. And it was very well-educated area, and that comes along on that Fertile Crescent. So Abraham leaves that. He comes into the land of Palestine. He has a growing set of children, and I think that may be somebody coming to the door there.
Mom!
Come on in. Hold on. Hey, welcome. Come on in. How you doing? How's it going? Grab you a book there. Grab you a book.
You know everybody.
We are just starting here on page one on the thumbnail of Israel's history, and you didn't miss much so far. So we are what we've mentioned, and we'll repeat the story for you. That first bullet there is the flood. The flood is somewhere between 5 and 10,000 B.C. The first history is before Abraham, about 3,500 B.C. About 3,500 B.C. is when we find the first writing. They dig it up in the city of Uruk. There's 5,500 documents, our first written documents, and they're all accounting documents. And I made the joke that the world's oldest profession is not the one we normally think it is. It's actually in accounting. So their receipts, their inventories, their reconciliations on herd counts between what came in and what went out. There's tax calculations that all show up in a rubbish pile that was saved in the rubbish pile. So apparently the statute of limitations had passed, and they had trashed that. So no Sarbanes-Oxley here. So about 3500 BC, and then we talked about the Fertile Crescent. That's in the Fertile Crescent where civilization cranked up. It's along the Tigris-Euphrates River, which would be Iraq, up through Iraq, Baghdad, up into Syria and Turkey, and then down along the coastline along the Mediterranean in Israel, Lebanon, Israel in today's terminology. So this is, when you traveled in the ancient Near East, unless you had an upscale camel, this is where you stayed, okay? Then Abraham, around 2000 B.C., gets a call from God. God says, okay, let's do something special here. Leave Babylon, leave down here at the Tigris-Euphrates. And so they travel along, he, his father, and his grandfather. They travel along the Fertile Crescent over to the land of Palestine. And they go through some very cultured, I pointed out the city of Ebla has a university. They had visiting professors back in those days, everything. It's very, there was a large library. We think that Abraham may have picked up some of the documents about Genesis and things of this type, some of the history before, you know, early in the world from perhaps that library. His access, he could have gotten some of that documents there and passed it down through Moses. So he comes into the land of Palestine. He and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, those three generations. Jacob will end up being renamed Israel. And from Jacob will come the 12 children that turn into the 12 tribes. So they're in the land, you know, three generations roughly. And then God's, there's a massive famine. And God does that famous Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat story where one of the children gets down to Egypt for the Pharaoh. And then the huge famine, Israel then, about 125 folk, move into Egypt once Joseph rises to power. And they live there in the 7 years of feast and 7 years of famine in the land of Egypt. And this, by the way, is in that 7 years, that's the transition in Egyptian power from where to where the Pharaoh owned all the land. And that was through that story of Joseph. Is prior to that, there was private property in Egypt all the way through up to recorded history up to that point. But if you remember in the story of Joseph, they had those years of famine. And Joseph had 7 years of plenty, and he had stored up all the grain. He'd had a second tax on the grain, and he put it all away. Smart, you know, God had revealed to him what was going to happen. We knew this kind of stuff on the market, stock market would be in great shape, you know. And then there were 7 years where just nothing happened, and eventually the people had to go to Joseph and buy grain. They ran out of money. Then they sold themselves into an indentured servant hood to Pharaoh, and then they sold all their land. So at the end of this period is where we get, from the rest of Egyptian history, the next 300 years, there's no private property. The Pharaoh is the land. He is Egypt. He is everything in this process. And that's why when, in the Exodus, when the confrontation between Moses and the Pharaoh is not only all of Egypt, he's also the god of Egypt. And so the confrontation is who's really the big God here. You know, the God of the slaves, the servants, the oppressed Israelites, or the person who owns all the land and all the power, you know, the elite. And so that there's a subtle play there. About either 1400 B.C., they're in Egypt a couple hundred years, between 200 and 400 years. And then we have the Exodus, the famous story of the Exodus. You know, the plagues, the 10 plagues, Moses. And somewhere in that period, Moses, the reluctant leader, you know, he was the one, the baby in the basket. Remember the story of Moses and the baby in the basket. He's raised in the court of Pharaoh. He's raised by the Pharaoh's daughter. He has access to all the wisdom of Egypt. We think that's where he gets some of the data that he uses in writing Genesis, the genealogies of the tribes of Edom, some of the nations that are descendants of Abraham, but who are not Jews. There's genealogies of that in the book of Genesis, and there had to be records somewhere. And since they were under the taxation of the Pharaoh at the time, he had access to all that data, had access to all the myths and all that stuff in Babylon and things of that type. So Moses then reluctantly, actually it's an interesting lesson. We have one psalm written by Moses. So when we go through 150 psalms, there's only one written by Moses. And it's very depressing. It's a very depressing psalm. It's a very realistic psalm because he had a rough go on it. Moses, because he's raised in the court of Pharaoh, he's a person of privilege. And so he goes out, but he knows he's Jewish, or Hebrew. There's no Jewish at this court. He knows he's a Hebrew. And he goes out to look upon, and he sees some Egyptian taskmaster mistreating an Egyptian, I mean one of his kinfolk, and he slays the Egyptian and thinks that they're going to recognize that he's their promised deliverer. Right? And so the next day he goes out and he finds two Hebrews fighting, and he wants to make himself a judge. And they say, who made you a judge over us? Just because you killed the Egyptian, and everybody knows this now. It's really illegal for him to kill a Jewish guy, to kill an Egyptian, whether he's raised in Pharaoh's court or not. And so he flees the land for 80 years, you know, for another 40 years, actually, scared to death for his life. And he runs over to Midian, and God humbles him in this process and teaches him this is not by might, not by power, not by learning, but this is by the heart. I got to teach you to be a shepherd before you go back and be a leader. And so he learned shepherding. He's never been a shepherd. See, he's been a student. He's been an aristocrat. And so he has to go learn shepherding for 40 years before God appears to him in the burning bush while he's out doing his duty taking care of sheep. See, so he comes back 1400, 1200 B.C. They do that Exodus, the parting of the Red Sea, the Charlton Heston, cameo and all that kind of stuff. They go through this. And then they start going, trying to go into the land. God had promised Abraham that he could have the land, but not until the people who were in the land were so bad he was going to evict them. In other words, he lives among the Amorites, and he tells Abraham, he says, look, in 400 years, roughly, I'm going to bring your descendants. I'm going to give them the land I promised you. But to use the biblical phrase, but the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. That's what his phrase is. In other words, I have to be patient with these people and give them the benefit of the doubt for another couple hundred years before it gets to some point where I've got to make a management judgment and evict them and give somebody else access to this land. And that's what he does. And God, what in the Old Testament and the New Testament, modern world, we will complain that God doesn't do something about some evil. Like in the Old Testament, we'll see this constant. We'll see it in the book of Psalms often. It's that God is being patient with the other side, who is also us at various levels, giving us time to clean up our act, to come to repentance, to change of heart, to waken up. And so what turns into the problem of evil, why we complain why God doesn't just bust the wicked, and bring us out of this, is that he's being patient with them to give them a chance just like he gives us chances, just at a different scale. So, God could either go bust them, and then he'd get known as a harsh God, or he's going to be patient and known as a soft on crime God. He can't win. It's a PR loss. You're going to lose this one. And God errs on the side of grace. He'd rather take the hit for being patient and good with us. So we'll see this in the psalmist. The psalmist will keep trying to force God to do something. And when the psalmist says the shoe's on the other foot, hey, cut me some slack here, Lord. Can you wait just a little longer? I can clean this up, I swear. Don't judge me. Don't bust me. And so this happens. So sojourn in Egypt, they go up. When they leave Egypt, from Egypt to Israel to the promised land is a seven-day journey. It's only 7 days journey. But they had gone in and spied out the land. They had sent these people ahead just to reconnoiter the land to see where it was and stuff like this. And the spies come back, and they haven't trusted God. And they see that there are fortified cities. We'll talk about cities a little later. They're cities with walls. And the people are giants in the land compared to little Israelites. you know, and they're scared to death. They don't think for a second. They're worried about this, that God brought them in here to kill them off. He said, yeah, God brought us out of Egypt so we'd die in a different place. Because what? And they use the phrase, what? There weren't enough graves in Egypt that you had to bring us over here to kill us in the promise? You know, I mean, a good little Semitic, you know, play with God there, just always arguing with him, you know, about this kind of stuff. They don't realize when they sit there and they worry and they fret and they're anxious and they despair that they don't trust God, who has just beaten the most powerful army in the universe at that particular time. The Egyptian Pharaoh had all the chariots, had all the military advantage. All the world was captive to Egypt at this particular point. And God has just whisked that away in the space of a couple of months, decimated their economy, and now they're afraid of a few natives in the land of Canaan. So God says, okay, this is going to be a learning experience. I can see this. They're going to forget in 7 days all this. So, nope, we're going to do something different. You're going to have a bypass. We're going to start over with the next generation. And then we get the 40 years in the wilderness. Remember where they're wandering around in the desert. And it's all on the Arabian Peninsula. Almost all this is, they're just going in circles in the Arabian Peninsula. He gives them the Ten Commandments and the law and the instructions. And they wander around for the 40 years in the wanderings, and then it says, okay, it's time to go now. This is where we have, by the way, one of our discussions about the age of accountability. Some denominations have an age of accountability issue, you know, or an understanding about when you become accountable. And the age of accountability for the Israelites was 20 years old. So when God says, okay, those of you that argued with me, you're not going to make it into the land. But the ones you said, when they argued with God, they said, why should we, God's going to take us in there to kill our children. You know, they use that as the excuse as for their lack of faith, right? And God says, okay, no, it's going to be actually the other way around. You're not going to be the ones to make it, but all of your children are going to make it. And so those 20 years and under are the ones that went into the land. Now they're not 20 years and up. They're now, what, 60? 40-year wandering. They're 20. They're between 60 and 40 adults. They, of course, had kids in the wilderness and stuff like that. And so, but at 20, see, you can see the mistakes of your folks real well. And you can sit there and say, I'm not going to do this. If we get another shot at this, I am not going to argue with God. Just, you know. And so they are the ones that go into the land. Now, they don't get to go directly in the land through that 7 little shortcut. They have to go up on the side. Now, the land of Israel, here's a little map I'll draw in the air. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the coastline. Okay? And here's the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee, a little smaller, about a third the size. So if this is the Dead Sea, this is the Sea of Galilee, and the River Jordan runs between the two. Okay? And most all of Israel is on this side. It's between the Dead Sea, the River Jordan, and the Mediterranean Sea. So this little narrow strip, about the size of New Jersey, okay, is the land of Israel. Now, that's where the Canaanites and the Philistines and all those big tall folks that they were afraid of live. So when they go in, instead of going on this side, coming in through the real hard spot, because there's some desert down here, God says, go around on the other side of Jordan. Trans-Jordan, the across Jordan, okay? Now, on this side are their kinfolk, descendants from Abraham, but not Jewish. So, remember, there's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, there's Abraham and Ishmael, and Abraham and Isaac. They're brothers. They're half-brothers, okay? And from Ishmael, by the way, is where we get all the Arabs. And the prophecy about Ishmael is that his descendants were going to be hostile to all his brothers all their lives. And that was written down a long time before the modern world. Okay. And so when Israel tries to come up the side, they send letters, diplomatic letters and messengers up to Moab and Edom and the nations that they've got distant blood ties to. And they say, would you let us go along what's called the King's Highway? There was a major road that went up there. It was a neutral road, the King's Highway. And they said, we'll go up here. I swear we won't go across the fences and eat all your food and take your cattle and, you know, drink your water. That's all we want. It's only a couple days' journey, march. to go up the king's highway. But no, they wouldn't do it. So they had to sometime go around, and they got in fights and all this kind of stuff. But eventually they get up there to just south of the Sea of Galilee, along the Jordan. They come and bank right there. And then Moses, because of some problems that Moses had had in disobedience with the Lord, God said, Moses, you're not gonna get to go into the land. I'll show it to you, but I'm actually going to take you to a better place. You're going to die on this side of Jordan, and you're going to have your assistant, Joshua, who was his personal assistant through all those years. And Joshua was one of those spies that went into the land. There were 40 spies that went in, and two of them came back and said, hey, think for a second, guys. He just whipped the Pharaoh. There's no limit to what we can do. This is great. The land was so fruitful that they brought back grapes that they were so big and it was so heavy they had to carry it on a stave between the, you know, like you would carry an animal. It was that heavy. The land was so fruitful back then. And Joshua always had a place of faith. And so he served under Moses, saw the miracles, and he made it in. And he was the one that's going to lead it. Joshua, by the way, is the Hebrew word that in the Greek is translated Jesus. So if Jesus would have been called Yeshua in modern Hebrew, but which is Yahshua in ancient Israel. So actually it was a forerunner of Jesus that actually brought him across the Jordan River. Okay, so we come then to the transition from Moses to Joshua and the entrance into the land. And Moses then, Moses had told, given them the law in the book of Exodus and Leviticus back at Mount Sinai 40 years earlier. And they had rehearsed it through the wilderness and things of this type. And before they go into the land, he gives them the law a second time, a second giving of the law, a Deutero second Nomos law, Deuteronomy. So the book of Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. It's Moses is going to die a week later after he gives the Deuteronomy. Okay, so they rehearse the law. Some of the laws change to reflect the fact that they're going to be living someplace as opposed to being in a camp traveling around. Okay, and then they go into the land, and Joshua leads him into the land at that famous Battle of Jericho. Okay, this is where that famous Battle of Jericho occurs when they go across the land. Jericho is one of the leading international centers of its day, a major military force. It's right there at the River Jordan. It's on a couple of major transit paths for international commerce. There are envoys from foreign nations, military attachés that are there at this famous Battle of Jericho, where they, you know, where the walls just come tumbling down, as the hymn says. Right, it's a very moment for God. He doesn't do a heavy lot of miracles in biblical history. That's not his way. He's quiet, spectacular. You know, he's not a spectacular God. He works quietly. He does sunsets and doesn't sign them. You know, he doesn't brag about this stuff. He does things quiet. But every now and then he has to make a point. And so he did it. He did it. The only thing we have, miracles we have in the Bible are concentrated in two or three periods. You get them with Moses. Okay, you have them with a few with Joshua in that transition there. The next set of miracles you got are with Elijah and Elisha, the northern kingdom. And that's all you got in the Old Testament. You don't have a lot of miracles. God didn't want us to do it on the basis of miracles. He didn't want to overpower our will. He wanted to woo us, that we fell in love, as opposed to being overwhelmed and afraid of this God. So he wanted respect, which we'll talk about a lot in the Psalms. But we have a big miracle there, and then the rest of it's conventional warfare as they drive out the inhabitants of the land. So there's a period, 40, 60 years, where they push out a million folk out of the land, basically, into the neighboring lands, and then they take over Israel, take over the land of Palestine. That's the conquest. And then they don't ever finish that job. They were told to finish it, but they don't. They get lazy. They say, hey, this is good enough. I'll tolerate all these people that I know are going to be bad influences on me. Not big enough for me to finish obeying God on this thing and cutting this off. It's just a little bad habit. I can live with this. You know, it's no big deal. And so then we get the period of judges. And the period of judges is where everybody does what's right in their own eyes, is what the biblical author says. So in the book of Judges, it says there was no king in Israel. There were no real teachers. Everybody just sort of did what they wanted to do, best they did, and it's a miserable existence. Judges, they're constantly being oppressed. There's no king. Government's real loose. The tribes hate one another. They're fighting one another over land and all this kind of stuff. And that's the conquest in the book of Judges. And then, because of external threats, Israel comes to, the various tribes come to the local prophet, the local priest. There's always been a high priest since Aaron, by the way. In other words, Moses, when God set up the law, he set up the tabernacle. Remember, there was a little tent. There was an altar. They did sacrifice, and the little tent moved around them with them. Well, Moses' older brother, Aaron, was appointed the high priest. And Aaron was the high priest and had the garments, the fancy garments, and he was in charge of all the sacrifices and all this, and the tithing, the taxation and things of that. That was his job and his descendants. And so there's always been a priest through this time. And they're, you know, some are good and some are bad. You know, they're religious leaders. Some are good, some are bad. And when you get into the period of Judges, they're pretty bad. Toward the end of it, God raises up a special one called Samuel, who wrote the book of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. And he's that special person that was born to Hannah, the lady Hannah, and starts in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel. 1 and Samuel. Well, Samuel is judging Israel, doing a pretty good job of it, leading them, teaching them about the law, you know, the book of Moses and stuff of this type. But the external threats are getting too great, and they finally come up and say, look, we're tired of being, since it's not working, us being on our own, we're not going to trust God. So the only other alternative is we want to be like everybody else and give us a king. And so they say, we want a united monarchy, and he warns them that the king is going to tax them heavy, that the best of your land is going to go, the best of your kids are going to go be bakers and cooks and, you know, be in the military, and the best of your fields are going to be, you know, taken over by, to support a monarchy. But, hey, if that's what you like, you know, if you'd rather do that than trust the Lord, go for it. You know, and God says, okay, give him one. And we get our first king, Saul. And they pick Saul because he's taller than everybody else, and he's a face man. He's handsome, and he's taller than everybody else, but he's just a coward. When they try to find out who it was that God, they found him hiding in the baggage. You know, they do this cast lots in the Old Testament where they said, okay, so where is he? And so they'd like roll the dice. Is he in this? They'd take the crowd, split it in half, said, okay, God, show us. Is it on this side? They'd flip a coin. Okay, somebody over here. And then they'd split that in half, and they'd keep doing the flipping the coin. It was a special thing that the high priest called Urim and the Thummim. They had the little stones, and we don't know how it worked, but that's how they did it. So like flipping a coin. And God would just guarantee the outcome. And they went through everybody, and he wasn't there. And so that God picked the prophet and said, he's over there hiding in the luggage. And sure enough, that's where Saul was. He was just hiding in the luggage because he was just scared of all the publicity and all this kind of stuff. So he turns out to be a pretty miserable king because he's afraid of everything. So every time the bad people tell him what to do, he does it. You know, he doesn't stand up for God, doesn't stand up for what's right. And then God says, you know, God was going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Said, hey, look, if you follow my law and do straight, I'll make you a full dynasty. There's no favoritism with God. I mean, even if he knows it's going to be bad, he still believes in it somehow. And then God says, goes over to Samuel the prophet, says, you know, I'm sorry I made Saul king. I put him in a bad situation. You know, he's not doing well. You know, I gave him the benefit of the doubt, and now he's in worse trouble than when he started. But I've got somebody else that's more humble than him that I've already picked, and his name is David. And he's a shepherd, in Bethlehem. He lives in Bethlehem, and go find him. And so Saul tries to kill David, of course, you know, over a 20-year period. And after David has been anointed and proclaimed king three times by God's prophets. So David knows he's supposed to be king. You know, he knows God. He knows God's faithful. And yet he's being chased constantly by this man's army to put him to death 10 years at least in the wilderness, in the caves. And it's in these caves that probably about 25% of the Psalms are written that says, now, Lord, let me see if I understand this correctly. You did tell me I was going to be king, right? You know? And so why? And that you were going to protect me. And so, like, help me understand here why the existing king you haven't dealt with yet, you know? And so we will have Psalms about that. He's trying to put that together, just like we do in our life when tragedy hits us and pressures are hitting us, and we'll sit there and go into the exact same thing. We'll say, I know exactly what you felt in the back of the cave there. Okay? And so he's going to go through a lot of period, and it's during that time a lot of our Psalms are written. And then finally, Saul is going to be killed in battle, and David will then become the king of all Israel. And now he's the king of all 12 tribes. And the high water mark of Israel's spirituality is in the reign of David. Okay? That's the high water of their heart. David is going to be succeeded by his son Solomon, Shlomo. Is what what his name is in Israel today. If you go over to Israel today, you'll see Shlomo this and some Shlomo Jacob. And Shlomo, you'd say, what an odd first name. Well, that's the name Solomon. That's the way it's written in the Hebrew. It's Shlomo. Okay? And so Solomon is Shlomo. If you read a Jewish commentary on any of this, and I got tons of them, you'll see Shlomo and Moshe. That's Moses. Like Moshe Dayan. That's Moses. Right? That's Hebrew Moses. So, David, and then Solomon is the wisest man in Israel's history. A great wealth, and Israel achieves its greatest material success under Solomon, and that's part of the downfall. Solomon makes all kind of political alliances. He has 3,000 wives, and almost all of those are political marriages. You know, they're not real marriages. You know, he's got 12 of those, but he's got about 3,000 marriages where the daughter of a pharaoh would come live in Jerusalem, and that represented an international treaty, right? Because you're not going to very well attack this country, you know, when you're married to one of these, and that's sort of like, you don't do that. You don't go attack Jerusalem because you might kill your kid. You know, so that was one of the deals, and this is a downfall for the nation. And Solomon ends up building idols for his wives to false gods. The gods specifically, God said, especially stay away from these gods because they were the gods of the land. It involved child sacrifice, things of this type. Really bad gods. And so at Solomon's death, God splits the kingdom in half. Because of Solomon's divided heart, he divides the kingdom. And so the northern 10 tribes leave the monarchy, and we have the Confederates go north and the Union stays south, so to speak, in this case. Okay? And so Judah, the tribe of Judah and Simeon and part of Benjamin, and Judah's where we get the word Jews from. It will become the word for Jews is the word Judah. Okay? And the northern 10 tribes will be known as Israel. Okay? So we have the divided monarch. And the kings of the northern kingdom are really, really bad. They're politically smart, but religiously very bad. Because one of the requirements of the Moses law is that three times a year, every man had to travel to Jerusalem for the Passover, the Feast of Pentecost, you know, and another feast, Tabernacles. And so this always drove the union, brought the nation back together because it was largely a feast. You know, your tithe, one-third of your tax money given to the temple, you were supposed to take it to the temple and then have a party with it. It didn't go to the pastor or the local priest. You were supposed to buy whatever you wanted to party with, all the people you brought from the land. And they say you could buy wine, beer, strong drink, meat. You never normally ate meat back in the ancient world. You normally ate grains. Meat was too, you never killed your animals because you needed them for milk and wool, you know, and those kind of products. So you never ate meat as a commoner back in the ancient world. The only time you ate it was when you had a sacrifice up at the temple. And so you'd go there and you'd have your barbecue and your beer and, you know, you'd play baseball, you know, you'd play whatever. We have Israelite games recorded in history, and some of them are really cute little games, little hoop games, you know, like roll the hoop we did as kids. And so it was a party, and it was to build a celebration. Religion was a celebration for all the goodness that God had given through the harvest. Well, needless to say, you know, if you're a northern kingdom and you're isolated from the southern kingdom, the last thing you're going to do is let everybody go down there and party with these folk and see the king and all the rival king and all his glory and all this kind of stuff and bond and create social attachments. So what do you have to do? Well, you have to create a counterfeit, an alternative. You got to create an American League. You got to create some other league. And so the downfall, and God had said, I'll make you a ruler of the 10 tribes, and you can be like Saul or David if you're doing it right. But this guy said, no, politically it doesn't make sense. So I'm going to put a rival altar. I'm going to set up rival priests. We're going to have our own set of feasts, our own gods. Wrong program. Sociologically, it makes perfect sense because he's going to build, keep his people indoors and, keep them there to where they're not going to see the true God. And, of course, God says, oops, boy, you messed up there. That's a real bad thing. And so all the good folk that weren't going to put up with it, guess where they went? They picked up their tents and moved south. So all you got, were the dredges. You got what was left up in the north. Okay, that's the divided kingdom. And God sends all the prophets, Elijah and Elisha, for example, are the prophets that went up there to try to call the kings to their, back to it. That doesn't work. And so there's about 150 years God puts up with this and then says, forget it. I'm going to carry you off in exile. Maybe you'll learn. 722 B.C., Assyria. The power of the Middle East at that particular time, Syria that we have now, the Assyrian warlords invade, capture the 10 tribes, scatter them all over the known world. That's the way they would do you, by the way. That's the way they would destroy your nation, is they'd transplant you to some other country, separate you, and then take those people and put you in their land, in your land. And so he resettled the northern kingdom with people that worshiped all kind of weird gods, and that's where we get half-breeds and all that kind of stuff. Judah is still semi-faithful. They see all this. They wake up. They say, oops, I don't want to go there. And they don't for about 150 years. 150 years, we have some good kings that show up, and then they get really bad. And then in 586 B.C., Babylon, who has conquered Assyria in this meantime, Babylon, famous Nebuchadnezzar, comes in, captures, decimates Judah, and carries the Jews in exile. And so the poor of the land stay there, and they keep Israel, a little bit there, Judah, and, they got just poor people farm the land. But all the intelligentsia, all the rich people, all just more Moroccan folk go over to Babylon, and they live in Babylon for 70 years. God had said, 70 years, you didn't do the land like I told you to, so the land's going to have its break. You were supposed to be, every 7 years, supposed to let the land go fallow. The Sabbath year, it was called. You weren't supposed to plant. You're supposed to give the land a break and yourself a break and all your hired hands a break and your kids, everybody that was working there was supposed to take off for a year. No, you didn't do it. You were rich and greedy and blah, blah, went after this stuff. You wouldn't listen. So I'm going to let the land have its break. And so the Sabbath years, there were 70 of those. There were 490 years in the land. And so 70 years, God says, okay, they get their Sabbath and you'll just sit here and learn this lesson. So they come back under Ezra and Nehemiah. And the books of Ezra and Nehemiah in the Old Testament are the return of the Jews to a very low-profile Judah, Jerusalem. Jerusalem was beautiful under Solomon. All this gold and silver. Oh, it was just amazing. And the kings eventually, depleted that. But when they came back, there was just nothing. The wall was broken down. Everybody was discouraged. And then they rebuild the nation, the city, but it's nothing like its former glory. And that's the second temple. The temple is rebuilt, and that's called the second temple, or Zerubbabel's temple. Okay, we now have 400 years of quiet. 400 years from the close of Malachi. The last book of the Old Testament is Malachi, or as one of my professors said, this was the only book written by an Italian, Malachi. The only book of Malachi. It closes there, and the last chapter of Malachi says, and the Lord whom you seek will come to his temple. It closes that way. And then there's 400 years of quiet. God's moving things around, Alexander the Great, and all this kind of stuff that we won't talk about probably in this period. And then the next thing occurs that the angel Gabriel goes to that young lady, Mary, in Gabriel, and the pronouncer and says, the time is here. When the fullness of time, as Paul said, when the fullness of time had come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem his people. Okay, so there's a 400-year gap. The second year, that second temple by Zerubbabel was a meager little thing. Everybody was discouraged. Their prophets, The minor prophets talk about, don't be discouraged about this. God is still there just because it's not fancy. God is a quiet God there. He's close. You stay there with Him. Right? And then Herod comes in under the Roman, when the Roman Empire conquers all that. You have the Assyrians, the conquered by the Babylonians, the Persians conquer the Babylonians, and then the Greece under that young Alexander boy conquer the Persians. And then eventually, of course, Rome conquers the Greeks. Right? Well, under Rome, we have Herod the Great, who is, shows up in the New Testament, period. He's the one that tries to kill all the kids Jesus' age, you know, the little babies. That's Herod. But Herod tried to befriend the Jews. He's half Jewish, and he's trying to insinuate himself to the Jews. So he puts a lot of money into the temple and builds it up. It's beautiful and glorious. So it's beautiful in Jesus' day. It's a beautiful temple in Jesus' day. And the Jews are very proud of it. Then from there, of course, we get Jesus, we get the apostles, and then the first and second Jewish war, where Israel is kicked out of the land. So about 64 A.D., that first Jewish war, there's a rebellion against Rome on the part of Jews. They get decimated. Jerusalem is basically ruined. It's burned. The temple is burned. But the Jews still get to live in the land, although with restrictions. And then at the second Jewish war, the big one's 132 A.D., the Bar Kokhba. They thought Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. And Bar Kokhba is where you get the famous Masada. You know, the story of Masada, that's in the Bar Kokhba, the great Jewish rebellion. And then Rome says, I'm through with you Jews, forget it. We're going to drive you, it's forbidden for a Jew to live in Jerusalem from then on under Roman rule. They're driven out. The city is renamed from the beautiful Jerusalem, the peace of God, the purity of God, to Ella Tola Capitolina. Name some Greek pagan god, you know, and the Jews are driven and they all move up to Galilee, and that's where the rabbis begin. The Mishnah, all the rabbinic literature are written in the land of Galilee. The Sanhedrin, all the great institutions that give us the Jewish religious literature, the Talmud, Mishnah, Gemaras, that's all written after this in this second century A.D., okay, late second century A.D. Okay. So that's the thumbnail, it was supposed to be a thumbnail, of Israel's history. Now the Psalms are occurring at that period of David, which is right around 1000 B.C. Okay, so we're at 1000 years before Christ, roughly. He's going to come to power about 1000 years, reign about 40-some, 50 years. Solomon's going to be in there. Solomon writes a couple of the Psalms. But a lot of the musicians are writing under David's ministry. David is a beautiful musician. A lot of the Psalms have musical terms. It says, to the tune of Dove of the Morning. Like we have no clue what that means. And that famous word Selah, S-E-L-A-H, that's like all through that, we have no idea what that means. All we know it's like at the bottom of hymns and hymnals, it'll have those little cryptic things that us non-musicians think, what does that mean? You know, and they'll have all these little things. And that's what these terms are, Hegion, Midoth, there's a whole bunch of things we have no clue what they mean, and we'll look at what we think it is as we go through this. So at a thousand BC plus or minus, you know, 100 years is where our Psalms are. And so point two is sort of, I just want to say what was going on in the rest of the world when this is going on, just in the context of this. Hold on, let me look at my okay. In the ancient Near Eastern, I got a list there. We're starting to get the downfall of Egypt. Egypt is on its 22nd dynasty. The Pharaoh Shishak, declining power. He's having trouble holding together. Assyria is dominant. They're fighting over lands. They're trying to avoid direct competition. But Assyria is the big kid on the block at this point. They've got everybody scared. And remember, Assyria is Syria and Turkey and part of that. Part of Iraq. But Iraq is the up-and-coming power, and so Assyria has to every now and then trim Babylon back a little bit. You know, take them down a little bit, put a little heavier taxation, go in there and teach them who's boss every now and then. And Babylon never forget this, and they come back and do the same thing. Assyrian supremacy, we have our first recorded strike, employee strike in all of history in this time in Egypt. There's some laborers that are not getting paid enough because of inflation. And they organized our first organized labor strike recorded in history then. The famous head of Nefertiti sculpture. You've seen that? That's from this period. This was at this period that sculpture was originated, was commissioned and done. Regulations concerning the sale of beer. Alcoholism is a problem in Egypt, and they have to put regulations in, so that you got liquor licenses, and how much you can have, and who can sell it and who can't. Wigs are used by aristocrats in Egypt and Assyria. Remember how the French kings, they used them because the hair smelled so bad because we didn't have shampoos. You know, you didn't have a lot of sanitation back in Europe in the Middle Ages. Imagine how much you had, you know, in the ancient Near East. Okay, whatever. And so wigs were used in the upper end. You can see them on the statues. So when you see in Iraq statues of the Assyrian Empire, they've got these long beards, but they've also got this long hair that's done in little, you know, those little curly stuff, and that's the wigs. We get the later pyramids of Egypt. There were earlier pyramids that were the great ones, and about this period we get the knockoffs, the cheaper pharaohs. Ramses are there. They don't have as much power. You know, like I said, they ain't got as much money. And we get the smaller versions. We get the portable versions, you know, of the Egypt. China is at the end of one of its glorious dynasties. The Shang Dynasty is coming to an end here. But China is very highly developed. They've got the Chinese cut ice, and they use it for refrigeration. They go up to the mountains. They have refrigeration. We have Chinese dictionary with 40,000 characters. You know, remember how the Chinese language has got all those little strokes done with the end? Each one of those stands for something, right? And the Chinese character for flood, the ancient Chinese character for flood, for example, was made of the symbols for a boat and eight people, Noah's Ark. That's their symbol for flood. Chinese math textbooks, they know the Pythagorean theorem back then, multiplication tables, equations in multiple unknowns, how to solve equations in multiple variables. Confucianism is rising as a philosophy in China. They are doing fish farming. They have, it's not catfish, but it would look very much like what we have here. They have ponds, and they have a manual, technical manuals written on fish farming. Beiping is already in existence. Been in existence all this time, like Damascus has been, and Baghdad has been in existence all this time. It's one of those old ones. There's prohibition in China. Not only did they regulate beer, they outlawed it. It got to be a problem for the monarchy there and the emperor, and so they outlawed it. And we have the fall of the wonderful Shang Dynasty. That was the first one that really unified China and developed a lot of the beautiful art. Silk is discovered about this time and is beginning to be transported and sold. In Europe, we're a little bit behind the rest of the world. The Iron Age is just moving. We're just learning to use iron implements, which had been used four centuries early in the Fertile Crescent. So Jerusalem and all these places, 400 years earlier, they have the Iron Age. And then the Iron Age moves to Europe. And so we're still in bronze, and we don't get a bronze in tin, and so we move to the Iron Age in the European. And India also moves into the, Southeast Asia moves into the Iron Age. So not everybody, when somebody says the Iron Age, you have to say where. Because there's a, you know, 4 or 5 century difference as to where it is. In Greece, the Greeks are just starting to write what's later going to become our ABCs. They've got those little alpha, betas, the thing that the New Testament has written. Those will later turn into our A symbols. Our capital A will look like an alpha symbol that came from the Phoenician alphabet. So we're getting to see the background of that. The famous Iliad and the Odyssey, the Homer, those are written here. We're starting to get the rise of city-states, but we are still 300 to 500 years before the smart people grow up, and before we get Aristotle and Plato and Socrates and all that philosophy. We don't have those people at this particular point. They don't show up until around 500 B.C. In India, the caste system develops. We get to where there's untouchables, where the stratification of people are such that you can't associate, you can't even touch the people under you, or you are defiled. You're a higher level of soul than people below you, and you get that harsh caste system, which still exists in some levels over in India. In the New World, over in the Americas, We get a sun pyramid in our only sun pyramid around this time, and we have the mounds of Poverty Point. So over here in Louisiana, across over here, Poverty Point, the Indians that are over here around 1000 B.C., they build the mounds that are over there. They have these large structures that are built, and they were basically settlements. They lived on those, and then they have a very large mound that was a ceremony mound. It would look like an Indian mound physically, but it's not an Indian mound like we think of it. It was a ceremonial mound, but not a burial mound. We don't get burial mounds for another 400 years. About 400 years, we start getting Indian mounds where they bury people up along the Ohio River. But right now, they're still doing ceremonies. Large earthworks are occurring everywhere. There's, like, say, the pyramids over here, these earthworks. And nobody writes yet. Writing doesn't develop for another 700 years over in our space that we know of. They would have used little tokens, little symbols, but they wouldn't have been like a language written down until about 300 B.C. Okay, that's sort of where the world is at this particular time. Now, Israelite life at the time of David, and this is key because this is going to explain why the Psalms look like they do. If you go read like Exodus or Genesis, it will look different than the short little Psalms. The Psalms are sort of broken. They read like a poetry. They have a vividness. They have an oddness. They have a harshness sometimes about them. And part of it is why they're written that way has to do with what Israel was like at the time it's written. So point three there is about villages and cities in the time of David. Now remember, this is the time of David. There are not a lot of large cities. Jerusalem at this time has been freshly conquered by David. Jerusalem is the size of Greenville, 30, 40,000 the size of Jerusalem. Most towns, little towns, are going to be between the size of Leland and Shaw, somewhere in the 2,000, 6,000 person range are where the cities, the big, the Megiddos of the world, the Hazors of the world are going to be about that size. The vast majority of the population are going to live in little villages the size of Elizabeth. Couple hundred folks, 50 families, something of that type. That's how it's going to be, okay? So there's not going to be a large population density because you can't. There's what's called a carrying capacity of land. You can only grow so much wheat, edible food, to support a population before the transport of the food goes bad. There's some distance factors in ancient economies that said how far can you be from water, how far can you be from a trade route, and the staples you eat have to be stuff that doesn't perish. It's got to be some foodstuffs that doesn't perish, and trade routes are always dangerous because of bandits, so you got to be in the backwoods, so you can't be in major metropolitan areas. So there are a number of factors that force the way the cities and the villages live. A lot of people would not live in a village because when you were conquered by a nation, guess where they're going to start? Every place of urban density they're going to go to. They're going to start the big ones, rob the folk there, because you have a greater possibility of having rich folk in urban density, right? Because you got management, you know, and you got rulers and you got governors and things of this type. Literacy. Now, literacy, surprisingly enough, Israel was a surprisingly literate society relative to the ancient world. Literacy was normally a professional craft of scribes. We have schools from the day that we have accounting documents. We have school documents. We have practice documents. In Israel, we have the back of a little bit later than this, but 700 B.C., 300 years later than this, we have ABCs, our Hebrew alphabets, Aleph, Beta, Gimeth. It's not ABCs, but that's their alphabet, which we'll see in the Psalms, where a school kid, a mom has gotten one of the kids at home to write it on the back of a piece of pottery that's broken. In other words, everything you used for scrap, you didn't have paper. So when you broke a vase, right, you used that ostraca, it's called. You use those shards of pottery for scratch paper. You use it for scraping things. You know, you had to recycle everything back then because it was costly. And so we have where a mother was apparently teaching a kid how to make the alphabet down there. We have stories in all over that period. Some of my favorite documents are school exercises, are letters from kids that go off to Scrabble school to become scraps. One of my favorite letters is a letter from a school kid who would have been about 16 back to his mom. And it's a letter that said, well, Johnny's, one of his schoolmates, mother must love him better than you love me because he has better sandwich food for lunch. You have just the standard kind of human things about jokes about teachers. You've been bald, and you know, you have these kind of letters, you know, that show up. Humanity doesn't change. It's always there. Love letters are there. Some of our earliest stuff are love poems and things of this type. Literacy is high, but nobody has time to do this. You're working all day long in the field. You're working all the day plowing, working with your animals. You know, nobody has time to do that. And the way you hear of news is at the fountain. The way you hear of news are two places. The smaller thing is you go to the water fountain, the big wells, and you sit there where everybody comes to draw wet water during the heat of the day. They draw water for their flocks. They draw water for the household. Jesus met the Samaritan woman, remember in John 4, at the well. At the time, people went out to get water. Okay, and you'd sit there, and there would always be the traveling songsters. And they would have the little hat out for tips. And they would tell the stories of what happened over in some other city. And sometimes they'd embellish it, but they would always make it poetry and entertaining. And you would hear about things. And sometimes there would be official messengers that would come, and they would stand there to tell what the king had decreed. Right? They didn't have paper that they could nail up to a door to do a decree. They could do monuments, and they would do monuments. You know, but normally it was done orally. And the other place you learn stuff were at the campfires. They still do this in the Bedouin communities where they have a special name for the campfire of learning. So periodically you would sit there and all the kids would sit there and all the elders, and the elders would go around and tell the stories of the past of their people. So the stories some of them are in the Psalms, some of them are in the book of Judges, some of the oldest literature we have in the Bible were circulated in these campfires. And this is the way you learned it. You sat there as a kid. Every Tuesday night, you went to the local campfire, you know, and you listened to the same thing every week for 40, 50 years. There were no TV, there were no iPods, there were no, you know, no entertainment to do but that. And all the social bonds were there, and you learned, and you respected, and you were quiet. And as you were growing up, they'd let you take a turn sometimes. They'd let you fill out a verse. And we'll see this, Lord willing, tonight. All the things were in poetry, but it was predictable where it was going to go. And they still do this. They still have Romanian folk tales where they have these. They're done inside now when it's cold. And the apprentices will the master will start telling a 400,000 line ballad from memory. Now that's a long story. And they would do it from memory, and they would change it every now and then, depending upon local, they might put in more detail about this particular town because you were in that town. You know, still true. Wouldn't necessarily make it up. But every now and then you'd say, and for this next verse, we're going to turn to my apprentice, Glenn. Take it from here, Glenn. And Glenn would freeze up. You know, he'd do his best. And then other people who had heard this thing for 40 years, they'd stop you. No, that didn't happen over there. He was over here. No, they weren't 40 years old. They were 43 years old, you know. And this is the way you learned. And literature passed orally in many cases this way. Okay? So literacy was still high among, because you had administration. Whenever you have government, you got to keep records. Whenever you have taxes and tithes, you keep records. So there's always a literary group that has to keep the records of Chronicles, the book of Chronicles, Kings, their prophets that write their prophecies about this bad king down so they can go back later and say, see, I told you so. If you had learned, listen, now here's the new one. Now learn this one so you don't have to, I don't have to end this story with it, and the Lord judged King Hezekiah, you know, so I don't have to write this down about you. And so literacy was there, very there, but the literary people, and this was the same all over the ancient world, The literature was done orally. Those, like I say, at the halls, at the meeting places, in the synagogue, they would pronounce that, and you would learn it from rote. That when somebody said it differently, you could catch it. The example I use is the Pledge of Allegiance. All of us grew up saying the Pledge of Allegiance every day, and you don't even think about it. You probably never saw it written. But if somebody starts saying the Pledge of Allegiance, if they mess up one word, and you're not even listening, right? You're not even listening. It'll catch your attention. And you'll say, whoa, wait, whoa. Something's off there. What was this? Who is Richard Stans? The Republic for Richard Stans? The Nation for Richard Stans? Richard Stans? No. For which it stands. That's it. Not Richard Stans. For which it stands. You know, and you catch it like that, and that's the way they would do this. And so the prophets could make allusions to Genesis 1 and 2. So Jeremiah gets up there, and he's talking about how bad it's going to be for the nation of Israel if they don't finally clean up. He's the last prophet before they get called into exile. And he gets up and he says, let me tell you how bad it's going to be. And he says, God is going to do this. And he quotes Genesis 1 and 2, and he uses the same phrases, tohu vabohu, and all the, and he says, God's going to uncreate. And so he says God's going to reverse what he did in Genesis 1 and 2. It's going to be that big of a change. And they would have caught that because they had heard Genesis 1 and 2 all their lives. And when he used that word, there would have been a shock value that says, oh, maybe I should take this guy seriously. And so they may have never read that piece, but they had heard it over and over. And the Psalms were repeated over and over in Sabbath schools and in festivals that we'll see through this. That's literacy. The homestead, like I say, these were all extended families. All the families lived together, grandparents, great-grandparents, all the way through great-grandchildren, because you were fighting a losing battle against mortality. 3 in 5 children died before the age of 4. Okay? And it took X number of people to farm the land. And you were constantly fighting a mortality. You had to have wives, and a lot of wives died in childbirth, a lot of serial wives that you had to do. You would have servants that would come that couldn't make it in a broken household. They'd move in with you. You might adopt them. But everybody was working together to drive subsistence living out of the land. The household was very, you protected one another. You stood by one another. The original houses, most of the people would have lived in what was called a four-room house, which would have been the size of this room and the sun porch, divided in basically four rooms, no door, you know, doorways, and partitions not up to the ceiling. It would have been like those float dividers, like cubby holes, you know, those kind of things. Those were four-room houses. The upper stratosphere would have lived in a villa that would have been like a circle, you know, with a courtyard in the middle, where they would have cooked. And all the servants lived in all the rooms with you. Everybody shared everything, you know, and it was just on pecking order as to how big your room was, you know, in terms of seniority and things like that. And that was the homestead. You lived there. Your land was normally there. Very rarely did you live on somebody, unless you were a tenant farmer. If you lost your land somehow, having to sell it, or if the government took it from you or something like that, that's the homestead. Tribal relations were always strained from day one. Remember in the story of Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, the brothers are still always fighting. They were fighting from the day they were born. It's a brother thing. They were always fighting, and they were going to continue to fight, and their kids were going to, it's Hatfield and McCoys. It's the way it was. That was the way it was. And God tried to bring them together around the feast. He tried to legislate doing good no matter what the tribe was, but the tribes were always very tribally oriented because, again, it was a homestead thing. You were true to your kin, my kin right or wrong. You did that. You know, even when they had done something very, very wrong and should be punished, you know, by the government, you would sometimes fight for them, and especially in the book of Judges this occurred. Government, in the time of David, like I say, we have our very first monarchy. There are no kings. Government is sort of by elders. So you'll see all the time about all the way through the Bible about the elders at the gate. I will not be afraid of my enemies at the gate. And what happened is that the villages and the cities, either they had walls or they didn't. They always had an entry point. They would have shrubs if they didn't have, you know, for visibility, if they couldn't afford a wall. They'd have a gate. And the elders of the city, the oldest, the wisest people, the landowners, would come twice a day, and they would sit there. And they would just chew the fat, and they'd argue politics, and they'd argue ethics. And then when somebody would say, I'm not treating me right, somebody's taking my land, they moved that marker, the little, you know, that said that was where my land, they moved it over a foot, I swear. It wasn't there. Look, see, look at all the bugs crawling out. You know, it's moved over. They moved it over so they could plant a tree there or something. You'd go before the elders and you'd say, what's the deal here? And the elders would make a group decision and judge your case. It may be putting you to death. It may be kicking you out of the assembly. It may be a corrupt. And you also did all your commercial transactions. When Abraham's wife died, God has not given him a foot of the land. He's going to give him to his descendants, remember? He's got to have a burial plot for Sarah. So he goes to the local pagans, descendants of the Hittites, and he goes to their gate. And the community of elders, and he goes in as a foreigner, and he says, I want to buy a plot of land from Ephraim here. Ephraim's got a plot of land. It's got a tree on it. It's got a little hill. He can build a cave in. They buried in caves. The richer people like Abraham would have buried inside a cave. He said, name your price and sell me this land. So it's all the commercial transactions are done with witnesses. And they sign it. There's all these ceremonies. If you don't fulfill your covenant, you made a covenant agreement, and somebody wanted to file suit against you or shame you, they would come, and then they would take off your sandal in front of the group. And you were called the person, the house of the unsandaled. And this was like a shaming technique. And it was all done in front of them. And so they would ostracize you. So you wouldn't get the best pricing, the marketplace. And, you know, if there was only five apples and there were five people, you know, there were only five apples and there were eight people in line, and you're an unsandaled dude and you've not helped the community, you hadn't given to United Way this year, you're not going to get your piece of the action here. And so this is the way social pressure worked to do conformity. The elders would also talk about the laws. And sometimes they would be traveling priests that would come through and teach the Mosaic Law. A lot of times they were just on their own. But government was done by the elders until they all got together and said, we want a king. We got to have a king because we need an army. And none of us are going to lead the army, so we need a king. So in case somebody's killed, it ain't us. It ain't us. So government grows up there. The government has no power at all. It's only a brutality power. They got an army. They have forced conscription for the army. You know, they have a draft, this kind of stuff. Religious life for the people at this particular time, they're supposed to go to the tabernacle. You know, the tent that came out with Moses, remember when God gave them there was the altar that they carried, you know, on the little platform where the Holy of Holies, and it was behind curtains, and then the curtains had a tent. And there was another wall, and there was a courtyard. That's where, and there were altars out there and candles, all this paraphernalia, right? The tabernacle was about the size of this whole house. So about the length of this house is what there would be a tent, approximately that size. And they'd fold that down during those 40 years in the wilderness, put it in packs, and you know they carried in seal skin. Actually, they had seal skin containers to protect against dew. And things of this type that they carried all the furnishings in and things of this type. And so they would walk around with this. Well, when they got into the land, they didn't carry it around anymore. But the pieces went to different holy sites. Some went to Bethel. Some went to Shiloh. Some went to Jerusalem. You know. And so people, when they wanted to get together for the feast, they'd go to one of those places. And that's where they would have the parties. They'd do their sacrifices. And they'd get some teaching. So they'd get some teaching. They might have the Psalms. If, for example, I got in trouble with God, I might want to do the old bargain with God. Say, God, look, I'm in trouble. If you get me out, I'll write a psalm. I swear. And I'll go read it in front of all the people that I'd be embarrassed to read it in front of. But I'll do it. Just bail me out. And God would sit there and make a decision. Do I want to teach them that that's the way this works or not? You know, I don't really want to teach them that this is a transaction that you buy me. But the guy's really in pain here. I'm going to risk them getting the wrong idea. And God's always making that tough call in our lives when we get in those situations, you know. But He'd honor it, so you'd make a vow, and then you'd go do a song. And then you'd go read it at the next one of those festivals or parties. The new moons, they were on a lunar calendar, and so the new moon, there was always a party at the new moon, at different villages throughout the land, and that was always a party. There'd be some religious instruction there, but not a whole lot. There wasn't much going on here, and that was because they were coming out of the book of Judges. In the book of Judges, everybody did what was right in their own life. They didn't tithe, so we didn't have an actual priesthood that could travel around and teach. They're supposed to live off of that stuff. Instead, they had to be farmers. So they had to teach part-time. You know, and that limited their travel because they had crops. And so the whole system broke down. It was supposed to be self-supporting. It was supposed to work wonderfully. But it didn't work like that. So religious right was a lot of a personal matter. And it was, like it is in many cases, word of mouth. You found somebody else that knew God and taught you about God. Sometimes it was in a psalm. Sometimes it was their life. You know, that you saw, and you sit there and say, what's different about you? Well, when I was 5 years, we were visiting that little thing up in Bethel. I heard that guy say about, if I meditate on the Word of God, that things, I'd be like a tree planted by the rivers of water. I thought about that, and I tried to do that, and I don't have but like 3 verses of the Bible, you know, but I've lived on the basis of 3 verses, and God's done this. This is the way it is in persecuted countries. They don't have a Bible. You know, they know 3 verses. It's all memory today, and God blesses it because it's verses. It's His instruction. International relationships at the time of David, it's starting to grow. Most of the people that are neighbors are at war with them. David is going to end up having to fight all of them because they want that land. Now that they've defeated all the big enemies, those tall guys, you know, driven them out. Now that little Jews are easy picking from Moab, Edom. And so David's going to be a man of war. And he's going to go through lots of fights and lots of bloodshed. And when it comes down, he wants to build the temple, that great temple. God's going to say, you've actually shed too much bloodshed. I can't do it. But your son Shlomo, the Hebrew word for peace, Shalom, Solomon, he will be a man of peace and he will build my house. And so David will donate all his vast fortune. And he will actually, God will give him the blueprint, and he'll give that to Solomon. And so he still gets to take a large part of it. So international relationships are pretty well strained at this particular point. They're always fighting these folk. And the relationships are on again, off again. When Saul is chasing David around, David sometimes will run over to Moab. Because Moab is going to be at war on and again with Israel. But Moab is in his family tree. Because during the period of Judges, there was a famine, and Naomi, this lady who's in the book of Ruth, she goes over to the land of Moab with her husband and 2 sons. They both die. She picks up 2 kids, Ruth and I forget the other one's name. And Ruth comes back. She's a Moabitess, foreigner Israel. They come back to, after the famine's over, they come back to Bethlehem. And Ruth turns out to marry Boaz, and Boaz is one of the precursors to Jesus. He's the grandfather of David, right? And so when David gets in trouble, and he fears for his family, right? He's going to run around in the caves, but he's not confident Saul is going to look at his family as being innocent. He takes his family and goes to Moab and puts them safely with his kinfolk in Moab. Later, David is going to flee to Moab himself, and later, Moab is going to attack David, and he's going to end up attacking Moab. You know, so it's on again, off again, different parts. You know, everybody was sort of schizophrenic mind-wise there during that time. Okay, so we get to the, got a few minutes for the nature of the Psalms. All right, so what I've got this is a lot of material here on the beginning. I hope we can get through this. Because I want to get into the parallelism so you begin to get a feel for this. This will go pretty quickly. And this is research material, just reference material about the background of the book. The Hebrew designation of Psalms is Tehillim, the Hebrew word for praises, a term that reflects much of the book's content. Because a lot of the Psalms are praises of either righteousness, God, or the righteous dude. Okay? Its name in Latin and English Bibles, however, comes from the Greek psalmoi, which means twangings of the harp strings. That's what psalmoi means, twang. Okay, so that's an old. So it's sort of a country western kind of thing, you know, title there. But don't tell those folks that, you know. Okay, and then as a result, songs sung to the accompaniment of harps. Its alternate title, Psalteron, means psaltery, a collection of harp songs, from which comes the English term psalter. So psalms are something that literally was a poetry that was sung. And sometimes it was actually performed, but it was generally done to psalms, and that's where it comes from. Psalms is organized into five books, and these are mentioned in the book. It'll say book one, book two, book three, book four, and book five in Psalms. And since the same psalm appears in more than one collection, for example, Psalm 14 and part of 40 are the same as 53 and 70, the latter has, it seems likely that each compilation originally experienced independent existence. So there might have been little portable versions of the Psalms that grew up in different settings and for different reasons. That one collection is mostly David. One is mostly some of David's musician friends. Okay. Furthermore, since the last psalm of each collection was composed with a terminal subscriptions, which means thus endeth the prayers of David, that were designed for the book as a whole, it appears that the origin of the five concluding psalms provides clues for the compilation of their respective books. Now, this is the most important paragraph. Each of the 150 psalms exhibits the formal character of Hebrew poetry. This consists not primarily in rhyme or even rhythmic balance, but rather in a parallelism of thought, whereby succeeding phrases either repeat or in some way elaborate the previous line. The poems vary in content. So one of the things that we're going to focus a lot on is how does that second line relate to the first line? Because they're going to always be related in some way, that's in some form of parallelism. Particularly significant, now it's not rhyming though, so it's not like a limerick where we have clues. A lot of times we have clues in English, you know, that a poem, how it's going to end. Roses are red, violets are blue, you know, sugar is sweet, and so are. There are only so many words you can put there that are going to rhyme with blue, okay? Unless you're using irony, and the Hebrew prophets use irony a lot, but we're not doing Hebrew prophets this decade. Particularly significant are the seven, especially messianic psalms, in which whole or in parts of which Christ either is referred to in the third person, is addressed in the second person, or himself speaks in the first person. So a famous one is Psalm 22, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That's Psalm 22. And that's David is saying that messianically about his own self, but the Spirit, the Holy Spirit is in his life also predicting about the coming messianic trials of Jesus. All right, then from a different source, it would be difficult to overestimate the significance for Jew and Gentile, and Gentile just means non-Jew, so we're all Gentiles, of the Book of Psalms. Here are mirrored the ideas of religious piety and communion with God, of sorrow for sin and search for perfection, of walking in darkness unafraid by the lamp of faith, of obedience to the law of God, delight in the worship of God, fellowship with the friends of God, reverence for the word of God, of humility under the chastening rod, trust when evil triumphs and wickedness prospers, serenity in the midst of the storm. The Hebrew poets were inspired to take these spiritual insights and experiences and make them the themes of their songs. But it should be remembered that, quote, the Psalms are poems, and poems intended to be sung, not doctrinal treatises, nor even sermons. Now, let me make a comment. What that means is this thing is going to be exceptionally vivid. We're going to have tremendously vivid and powerful images, which may not be the most precise of images because it's poetry, as you would get in a catechism or a book of doctrine. So the creeds of your churches would have words like consubstantiality and hypostases and the second person of the Trinity. You won't get here. You'll get, I am a worm and not a man. If you wanted to prove that the Holy Spirit was an actual worm, you would use that text. I am a worm and not a man. See, you can't prove text out of Psalms the way you can out of the epistles in the New Testament. So it will be more vivid, it will speak to our heart, and it will challenge us a whole lot more, but it won't be something you'll have to be careful when you go to get doctrine out of and defend a doctrinal position. If we skip down to, let's skip down to number five, because I want to make a comment about in the remaining 7 minutes.
7 minutes, we're going to cover the next four pages. So we should be able to do this. This is where that 7 minute cool down is supposed to occur. The notion of parallelism and chiasm. The poetry of the Psalms. The chief characteristic of Hebrew poetry in the Bible is balance or symmetry, commonly called parallelism. Biblical poetry is also marked by the use of repetition, a fondness for alphabetical acrostics, and the employment of metaphor and simile. Now, alphabetical acrostics. Now, an acrostic is a poem that where it all starts with like the same letter. So if I wrote a poem where every line started with B, B this, B that, you know, letter B, that's an acrostic, like we do in crossword puzzles and stuff of this type. Well, because that's very memorable, you can imagine it being told at a fountain. They're going to write the psalm. So the longest psalm we have is Psalm 119. It's 16 chapters in itself, each of which is 16 verses. Okay? Because there are 16 consonants in the Hebrew language. And of the 16, each section is 16 verses that start with the same letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And it's each 16, successive 16 is the next letter in the alphabet. So it'd be like if I wrote 22, how many we got? 22, 26? 20 consonants now. That's 26 letters. So 7 vowels. You work it out. I'll just use 22 as a round number. Okay. So 22 consonants. It'd be like if I wrote a psalm of 22 chapters. Each chapter was 22 verses. And the first 22 started with B. Then the next one were 22 verses with C. And then D. See, you have to work at that. But guess what? You'll be able to remember that after you hear that for a while. And you will never be tempted in the middle of the B verse to suggest that something started with C. it was a safeguard. So it was alert. We will see acrostics in the Psalms. It's beautiful. You can't see it in English. Hello, hello. But we'll point that out. As a matter of fact, if you go to the English printed Bibles of Psalm 119, they have the Hebrew character printed. They'll say Aleph, Beit, Gimel, and they'll show actually what the Hebrew. Now we will have it because in your text you'll have the Hebrew text of each one of the Psalms. Maybe not Psalm 119, but you'll see that when we look at Psalm 1, we will be working with the Hebrew text, so you see where it is. Okay, with the English under it. Okay, so that's the acrostics. They will use all of these beautiful literary things in this, and we won't get to see a lot of it because we won't be working Hebrew, but you'll get a flavor for it. So the 2 or 3 more minutes here, and then I got to shift gears. The poetry of the Psalms. Okay, so balance of parallelism. A line of Hebrew poetry is made up of two parts or colon, singular colon, which may be added A and B. For example, A, when Israel went forth from Egypt, B, the house of Jacob from a people of strange language. So you see the parallelism there, right? Because Israel matches what?
Jacob.
The house of Jacob, and Egypt matches the phrase people of strange language. So that's a synonymous. Those are synonyms, the same kind of thing. If you go to the next page, here's one where the lines balance. So here you have A plus B and A prime plus B prime. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. So that matches in two different directions. Okay. Then the next one is good. In the examples given, the ordering of the words and the balancing cola is the same. Israel and Egypt is balanced by house of Jacob, piece of same language. The order may be represented as A plus B balanced by A plus B plus. The order may also fall into a chiastic pattern where A plus B is balanced by the reverse, B plus A. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. See how it's reversed? And it goes in like this and then comes back out. So his mischief returns upon his own head, on his own pate, the violence descends. See how that's A plus B goes to B plus A? And then praise the Lord with a lyre, with a 10-stringed harp, make melody to him. See, that's a chiasm there? And that's a chiasm when it goes in and out. So there's a parallel. Now, I'm going to let you look at the other relationships, you know, where B supports A, you know. But I want to skip to to page 6 to the chiasm. Because we're going to see a lot of this all the way through this. Chiasm is a literary device of structure wherein the order of topics discussed is reversed after some pivotal point or couplet. Chiasm facilitates memory of the material since the order of either half of the structure can be calculated from the other half. In other words, if you get half of it, you can back out. It's like an accounting trick. If you can back it out, you know, if you got it right. So here's the word order in Genesis 8 and 9. Noah, and the indentation is each one. So if you look at the top and the bottom, Noah matches Noah. Found favor is walked. In the eyes of the Lord with God. These are the generations of Noah in his generations. Noah was a righteous man, perfect he was. See how that's a chiasm there? It goes down and then out. Look at the entire story of Abraham in the text. That's a chiasm. So A goes down through H and then backs out to A prime. Look at the top. Abraham's call, promise of the seed, matched down at the bottom by Abraham's test, blessing of the seed. Now, the reason this is important because this is what was told at the campfires. So if I come in late in the middle of this, guess what? I can figure out what was going on. I can reconstruct the story. I know where it is. Look at the next page. The entire flood story is this way. Genesis 6:10 through 9:19. If you look at that, it's a very long one. And you can see that would have taken a while at the campfire to tell the story there. But it starts with Noah, ends with Noah. Next line, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ark, flood announced, no flood in the future. Perfectly symmetrical. It's perfectly there. This will show up all the way through Hebrew life. It shows up in the New Testament. In that incredible thing in the book of Philippians, where he's trying to teach us to be humble. Philippians 2, when he's going to give us the big example of this. He said, let the mind be in you which was in Christ Jesus, who being the very form of God. And then he walks down a chiasm. Did not consider equality with God to be something to held on to. But he took upon himself the nature of a servant, being even down to being a man, even down to a death, even to the worst kind of death. And for this cause, God exalted him, raised him from the back, him all up, until the final one is he's given the name that is above every other name, the name of God. He's called God. And so you don't. And that was a hymn. Psalms are hymns, and that section is an ancient hymn in the church. And so when Paul wants to just rub it in their faces that said, this is what you sing every Sabbath or first day, this is the step down, descent into suffering and humility, God will exalt you. That's a key answer. We have these all through the Bible, and it comes from this memory work. And so chiasm is important. There's a chance there that the story of biblical history is a chiasm in itself, and that's a separate issue. I'll just mention it. The creation of the heavens and the earth matches the creation of the new heavens of the earth at the end of time. Humanity's rebellion against God in Genesis 3-11. Humanity's rebellion against God in Revelation. Now, you have to be a premillennial. You got to believe in a rapture and the millennium and the church age for this to work. And the people that wrote this did do this. And so that's how this works, why the hidden age works. But it's an interesting theory about this. So when we get to... I want to look at just this last page, and we're going to read, just so at least we've said we touched on a psalm tonight. We're going to at least read Psalm 1 and then dive into this next time. So the next one is this Hebrew interlinear, the page 8 of 19 you should have. It's after the blue sheet in yours. And Hebrew reads right to left. So we're going to be reading from the right margin where it's starting with the 1-1, and we're going to read right to left and go down the page. Okay? And this is the word order in the Hebrew with the English under it. So the blessedness, can you follow me over there where I am? Uh-huh. The blessedness of the man, which is how blessed is man. They didn't use verbs often. If they wanted for punch, they'd say, blessed man. That punch. Like, food, bad. You know, that's punch. Not food is bad. Just food, bad. So, blessed the man. who not, it starts with a negative, who not he walks in the counsel of the wicked ones. Next line. Or in the way of sinners, not he stands. Or in the seat of the ones who mock, not he sits. So you have, there's three of those going across there. Guess how many we're going to have coming back up? You got it. You got it. Verse 2. But rather, in the law of Yahweh is his delight, and on the law of him he meditates by day and night. And he, verse 3, and he, this righteous, is like a tree being planted by streams of waters, which the fruit of him he yields in his season, and his leaf not he withers. And all that he does, he prospers. Not so the wicked ones. Now this is a chiasm that's backing out. See, we'll see, actually. Yeah, just look over at the next page under that little A. Section A. You'll see how the chiasm works. See, on page 9, after the text, there's the A, and then there's that little chiasm structure. The way of blessedness. Next is continuance in God's law. The enduring fruit tree, the impermanent chaff, not standing in the backside of the way of perishing, over against the way of the righteous. That's second half. All right, let's go back to the Hebrew here. Sorry. We were at verse 4. Not so the wicked ones, but rather like the chaff that she blows away the wind. It was there like the chaff that blows away the wind. For this not they will stand, the wicked ones, in the judgment, or sinners in the assembly of the righteous ones. For watching over Yahweh, the way of the righteous ones, but the way of the wicked ones, she will perish. Okay? So we will see a ton of parallelism in there, contrast between that. And the only thought I would just leave you with here before we close in prayer is, and we'll see this, I don't think I actually have it, is the image of chaff, the wicked being chaff. In the agricultural society, we don't do it nowadays, but where you would take your wheat and your grain, you would go into the threshing floor. And it's covered by the husk, which is useless in these particular grains. It's good and ripe, but not in these foods. And then they would thresh it. So they would beat it with, you know, the threshing things and pulverize the stuff. And it still got the bad mixed in with the good, right? And so they would scoop up the mixture of chaff and wheat, right? And they throw it in the air. Because it's always windy coming off the Mediterranean plain there, going to the mountains. And they would throw it in. And the wind would blow away the lighter stuff, the chaff. And the stuff that would fall to the ground would be the good stuff that you lived off of. The stuff of substance. The stuff that would remain. The stuff that built life and fed families. And the chaff just blew away because it wasn't relevant. They were petty. You know, they weren't dealing with the real issues. You know, they weren't full of life. They weren't the real stuff. And that's the image of the wicked, that they just sort of don't count. You know, they don't make, you know, they're going to be, in other Psalms, they're going to be real problems for us, right? But in the final analysis, when it's all said and done, the righteous are the ones you go to in times of trouble. When you need help, you go to them. You don't go to the petty folk. You don't go to the socialites. You go to the people that have been there and done that, that live. And this is the image that's going to grow out of the tree and the difference between the life that grows from the soil that God gives and things of this type. That's what we're going to get into in the characteristic differences between the righteous and the actively treacherous, which is this word wicked is the word treacherous, which we'll talk about in detail next time. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for your love and your goodness and the fact that you did break into history and the lives of these people, and you have shared with them things that they share with us. And that your word is true today for us as it is for them. And we would like to walk with you like so many of them walked with you, to discover you as a companion as we explore our life and the challenges as we deal with these issues. And may we reflect upon the goodness of your heart and the communication, the way you did care enough for us to not remain aloof, but to break into history and to bring us songs at the watering places and to bring us the word that passed down and the straika where it's written down and the scrolls and things to tell us of your good heart, of your love, of your provision, of your eagerness to be a part of our life, a warm part of our life, a gentle part of our life, a comforting part of our life. We can never thank you enough for the forgiveness of sins that was bought at the cross by the one who uttered Psalm 22. We thank you for him, and may we fall in love with him more. In Jesus' name, amen.